7. My eyes are open. There's nothing to see. I pick at the crust settled in my tear ducts, the residue of yesterday's mascara stuck to my lashes. I've been asleep for a long time. I yawn and turn over onto my stomach. I've leaned into a cloud of my own morning breath, and it's lethal. I'm awake now. I wish I wasn't. I feel like I've been hit by a truck. I fumble around for my phone on the nightstand. It's dead. I reach for my charger. Where the hell did I put it? The outbreak of goosebumps tips me off on what my brain is slow to process. Then comes the sinking feeling, an anchor dropping, dropping, finding no bottom, no place to rest. Last night. Whatever's happening here, whatever's happening with Julie, it's worse than we thought or could have ever imagined. I shove my face into the pillow. Fuck! I have to find Molly and May. I have to tell them about last night, about what Tristan told me. Anticipating the looks on their faces, I can't stand it. What time is it? Must be mid-morning at least. Gray light fills the gaps between the window frame and the curtains. I reach over to open the curtains. I hesitate. What if someone's there? What if I pull back the curtains and there's a figure standing there, looking down on me with dark, hollow eyes? I open the curtains, and no one's there to greet me. Just another rainy day. The trees are stiff and naked. The wind must have seized the leaves yesterday during its tantrum while it was running around screaming its head off. There's a layer of frost over the grass, icy spines holding it at attention. Thanks for nothing, October. When I was little, 5 or 6, I got lost at the mall. I was a pretty spacey kid, and I wasn't paying attention to where I was going. I got distracted people watching or peering into store windows. And when it eventually became clear I had wandered off, I saw Lou, ran to her, touched her leg. And when she looked back at me, she had a different face. It wasn't Lou. Just another tall woman in jeans. She had the same hair, long, thick, and dark, in a ponytail that swiped the small of her back. When that woman looked at me, I started to cry. She didn't stop to ask me why. She kept walking. I had to find the security kiosk on my own. I remember telling myself, "Don't look lost, don't look lost." If a stranger saw me and realized I was lost, realized I was alone, he might take me. Lou had warned me about strangers. So had Miss Chantel, my kindergarten teacher. I was incredulous. I never thought it could happen to me, getting lost, getting taken. It happened to other kids, stupid kids, loud kids with overbites who didn't listen in class. I saw a man in a security uniform and approached him. He walked me to the kiosk, and Lou was there waiting. She was biting her nails, her nervous habit. But when she saw how upset I was, she relaxed. She was good at that, at adapting her mood to fit my needs. "Hey, kiddo," she said, "too cool to shop with me?" I sobbed and hugged her legs. She took me to the food court, and we ate Nathan's hot dogs and crinkle-cut fries covered in soupy orange cheese. It was the first time in my life I had felt like I was in danger. I realized I'd taken my safety for granted. I realized it was possible to get lost and not know how to get back. I learned what it was like to feel helpless. That's exactly how I feel now. Like I'm helpless. Like I'm in danger. I'm wearing yesterday's clothes. I don't bother to change. I'm torn between a powerful sense of urgency and an even more powerful sense of dread. Between accepting what's happening and refusing to accept what's happening, or refusing to do anything about it. I'm scared. I dig for the version of myself who broke into her lover's family's house. I need that version right now. I'm not brave, but I can detach from reality enough not to be as scared as I should be. I open the door. I go down the hall to May's room. I knock. No answer. They're probably in the dining room. There are actually people out and about today. People walking with their suitcases rolling at their heels. There's a crowd at the bottom of the stairs. The hotel has been pretty empty since we got here, so it's a little weird. They're all talking in hushed voices. I hear S's and P's. My chest tightens. Maybe it's just a big group all checking out at once. The lounge is empty. The fireplace is dark. It coughed up some ash onto the hearth no one bothered to sweep up. There's an open book on one of the couches. I close it to look at the cover. The Magic of the Catskills, Images. I set it on a nearby end table, next to a lonely mug with pink lipstick smudged around the rim. It's 3/4 full of a black liquid that's either coffee or tea. I hold my hand over it. Whatever it is, it's cold. On the floor, there's a used napkin marked with the same pink lipstick. I leave it, even though its presence there makes me itch. I don't like a mess. The slight disorder of the scene isn't sitting right with me. But whoever left the lipstick might have spit into that napkin, sneezed into it. I don't know. Elise! Molly is rushing toward me. Elise, what the fuck? I've been calling you for hours. My phone is dead. Why? What's up? What's up? Hello? Everyone's leaving. They're closing the hotel. Something weird's going on, she says. She's in a frenzy. Her hair is disheveled, her eyes dark and wild. May is still sick, and I don't feel so hot either. What do you mean? Why? Where's May? May's in my room. I went to check on her this morning and just... She pauses, puts her hand over her mouth. She takes a deep breath. She sweat through her sheets, and she's like completely out of it. It's scaring me. Where's Julie? Straight to voicemail. I figured you were together. No, I just woke up, I say. Molly, I have to tell you something. Not now, Lise. I need, like, toast or crackers or something for May. A bottle of water or, like, a Gatorade or something with electrolytes. I have to get back to my room. I left her alone. Can you get something and meet us there? Get your bags and shit, too. We need to get out of here. Okay, yeah. What a fucking nightmare, she says, hurrying away. Fucking nightmare! If she thinks things are bad now, wait until I tell her about Julie. Spitting out teeth, the raw meat, the smell. The hotel is closing. We're leaving. I would be relieved if I could only get past the horrible nag of why. The bar is empty. There's no one behind it. There are glasses out. Most still have some drink left in them. A few with a stray maraschino cherry or orange rind. They sweat onto thin, multicolored coasters monogrammed with RH in a romantic font. The Red Honey Inn. Not knowing what else to do, I walk behind the bar. There's a bucket of melting ice on the floor. A scoop floats idly inside on its back. Beside the bucket, there are a pile of dirty dish rags and a lone bar spoon. I've always thought bar spoons look like weapons, with their long, twisted handles. The placement of this particular spoon isn't helping to convince me otherwise. There's a mini fridge full of Red Bull. No water, no Gatorade. I leave the bar and step onto the carpet in the dining room. There's a web of booths in front of me, too many to count. They're all empty. My eyes travel back and forth until they catch on each other. Hello? I hear myself say. The word echoes in this vault of a room. My heart turns elastic. It's expanding, filling my whole body, my forehead, my gut, down to my littlest toes. It's flooding my ears with its mounting thumps. Hello? I say. More loudly this time, hoping to make the walls shake. I take a glass off a table just to prove that I can, to prove that this isn't a dream, that I'm real. I hold it in my hand. and it's not a relief. Can someone help me? Some of the tables are clean set, but most haven't been cleared. Plates linger, food picked over. There are flies devouring stacks of pancakes and scrambled eggs. There's toast covered in jam with a single bite taken out. More cups of cold coffee. Overflows of cream curdling in shallow saucers. When is this from? Some chairs are turned over, on their sides, their backs, their fronts. It almost looks intentional, like an abstract art exhibit at MoMA that people would call provocative because they think it makes them sound insightful. Something about this feels like an elaborate prank. It looks staged. Hello! Somewhere, a pan drops on the floor, making the sound of a church bell. I make my way through the obstacle course of chairs and booths, push open the kitchen door. Hello, I'm looking for... I'm crossing the threshold into the kitchen when it occurs to me that maybe I shouldn't be heading toward the noise. Maybe I should be running from it. My shoes squeak against the linoleum. I slide. I look down at what's slippery. It's very red. The kitchen is drenched in blood. There are slaughtered body parts strewn across the floor, unraveled intestines, pulsing, spongy chunks. There's a detached pink head at my feet with fuzzy flesh-colored ears. A pig's. It's a pig's. The scene is so gruesome, so grisly. I'm caught seizing in a fit of panicked dry heaves. I can feel none of my body. I'm a convulsing chest. There are two hulking double fridges to my left, and directly in front of me is the window, with incomplete tickets hanging down, spaced like adolescent teeth. Through it, I can see the line, a series of ovens and stovetops. There are pots and pans on the stove, the contents filmy, spotted, deformed. I get sick in my mouth and spit it away from me. The sharp ringing in my ears gives way to a frantic thrashing. I assume it's my organs rioting from the inside, but soon it's clear it's not coming from me. It's coming from somewhere in the kitchen. To the right, there's a short hallway, more fridges, more ovens. There's probably a freezer back there, a nook for fresh produce or racks of baked goods. There must be a person hiding, making this horrible noise. But it's not a person noise. It's a thick, slimy sound. I've never heard anything like it. I look down at the pig's head, as its mouth falls open, tongue bobs, as it begins to glide around, glide toward me on a river of its own blood. I stumble backward. I get the fuck out of the kitchen. A butchering accident? A bear attack? What other possible explanation? How was it moving its mouth like that? I swear I saw it blink. Do pigs keep on living after their heads get cut off? Like chickens? Is that just a rumor? Something the class bully tells girls during recess to make them shriek? How long do our bodies go on without us? Twitching, free of thought. Is this why the hotel is closing? I have to get back to my room. Get my car keys. I have to get back to Molly and May. My phone is dead and useless in my back pocket. I have to go. I trip over my feet running through the dining room, past the bar, out of the lounge. I bang my shins falling up the staircase. I'm sprinting down the hall, room key in hand. But it's that thing, isn't it? My body is so panicked, it can't do anything right. It can't even open a goddamn door. I finally get it open, slip inside, lock it behind me. Car keys. I need my car keys. I grab them in my wallet out of my purse and put them in my pockets. I toss my bag onto the bed and start packing. My hands are shaking so badly I have to stop. I take a deep breath, attempt to make fists. When I look up, I notice that the sliver of light on the right-hand side of the window where the curtain falls just shy of meeting the frame, is missing, mostly. There's still light coming in from above, from the top, but it stops at the height of a very tall person. There's a very tall person standing outside my window. I don't know how long they've been there. They're watching me. This I'm sure of, because when I see them, they bang on the glass. I fall backward, like there's a string tied around my spine being pulled by some almighty force, like I'm a marionette. My limbs extend at odd angles, swinging around my joints unrestrained. There's more banging on the window. The glass is on the verge of cracking. I hear it squealing. My body is now working without me. I'm out in the hall. My room door is shut behind me. I'm on alien legs. They're not mine. I've never seen my legs move this way, this efficiently. I visualize myself running past reception, through the lobby, out the front doors, onto the lawn, leaving garden gnomes in my dust as I hurl myself across the parking lot to my car. I'll start the engine, lock the doors, peel out of here. But I can't. I need Molly and May. I turn a corner and nearly smash into someone. It's Patsy. Her hair's insane. She's wearing ripped khakis and a ratty gift shop t-shirt that reads, Hilton Head. Pardon me, she says. I need you to please head to the lobby for checkout. I can't articulate. I can't catch my breath. She clears her throat. We're closing the hotel. Why? She clears her throat again. I'm sorry, miss. We're closing the hotel due to a staffing issue. Staffing issue? Yes. Now, if I can please ask you to gather your luggage and sign out in the lobby. Is this about the pig? I ask. She frowns. The pig? If she doesn't know, I'm not going to be the one to tell her. What do you mean, staffing issues? I ask. She sighs. We're having trouble locating some of the staff. We want our guests to have the best possible experience, and unfortunately... The receptionist? The girl who checked me in? She wore vintage glasses. Where is she? Patsy takes the question like a big pill, with a hard swallow, her head back. She pauses, and it's long enough for me to know she's not going to give me an answer. We do not currently have enough staff to run the hotel properly. We're very sorry for the inconvenience, she says. She looks like she hasn't slept in days. You will be issued a full refund for the duration of your stay. We hope that you understand and that you'll come visit us again soon. Someone just tried to break into my room, I tell her. There's something else going on here. No one's ever looked at me the way she's looking at me, with what might be pity or disdain. Where's your luggage? It's still in my room. I can assist you. Cassandra suite, yes?
Yeah.
She puts her hand on the small of my back to direct me toward the stairs. I don't want to go back up there. Actually, I need to meet my friends. I'll get my stuff later. I can get it for you. You can pick it up when you check out. No, I'll get it later, I say. It's fine. I insist. It's the least I can do. I lean into her. I don't think you should go upstairs. I'm going to bring your things to reception. They'll be here when you check out. And please, do check out as soon as possible. She's not going to listen to me. She's not going to take no for an answer. She doesn't understand. Be careful, I tell her. She nods, lingers, looks at me funny for an excess of seconds. Her brows sink and her lips snap together. I can see the wiry gray hairs at her temples, not long enough to be confined by her giant hair clip, which looks like some kind of crustacean adhered to the side of her head. I can smell her BO and the gardenia perfume she slathered on her pulse points this morning. Will do, she says. She jingles the set of keys she's wearing around her wrist like a gaudy bracelet. The sound fades as she walks away. I sprint to Molly's room. She's got the door open before I finish knocking. She looks me up and down. Where are the crackers? I couldn't find any, I say. I don't see the point in telling her about the pig or what just happened in my room. It will only make things worse, more chaotic. The kitchen was locked. She lets out an exasperated breath. I've got all our shit packed. I'll need your help getting May out to the car. May is folded delicately on the bed. Her opalescent hair is set in a neat bun at the top of her head. She's wearing silk pants and a matching blouse. Forever chic. She sits up. Lise? May, relax. You're making yourself sicker, Molly says. Hey, honey. I kneel at the edge of the bed. Hanging in? This weekend, she says, it's on me. It's not, Mabes. Don't worry about it, okay? Oh, God. Molly's patience is up. We have to get you to a doctor, miss, I tell May. You ready? She slowly swings her legs around. Wait, she says, patting my hand. Where's Julie? I look down at my hands. I see they're shaking. I see my nails, bitten into jagged stubs. I wanted to get a manicure before this trip, but I couldn't afford it. I wanted to pick a fun color and have May say something nice. A compliment from her means something more. It just does. Julie? May asks again. She's not here, Molly says. She probably left an hour ago, like when we should have left. Come on, May. Elise, help her. Molly's got the bags hanging off her shoulders. Did you talk to Tristan? May asks me. I don't know what it is. Her hand perched on mine, small and fragile like a baby bird. Or maybe it's her eyes. She's not wearing her glasses. There's no barrier between us, and her eyes are so beautiful, an ancient blue. It's exhuming the guilt, the shame of what I've omitted, to them and to myself. I should have told them last night. I should have told them as soon as I got off the phone with Tristan. What do I say now? What is it? May asks me. What? Molly shifts her weight and sets the bags down. Did you have the conversation with Julie last night? What conversation? May asks. I tried. She said she was fine, but she looked, I don't know, unwell. She was eating beef jerky and she lost another tooth, I say. When I talked to Tristan, he said some things. I should have told you. Told me what? Molly asks. I put my palms over my eyes. He saw her sleeping outside and eating raw meat. I imagine this is what it's like in the immediate aftermath of an explosion, a moment suspended in shock. I understand now the truth of why I didn't tell them. We might never come back from this. This might be the end of us. What the fuck is wrong with you? How could you not tell us? What the hell were you thinking? Molly, May says. Elise, I love you. You know I do. But I swear to God, you need to wake the fuck up. Wake up, both of you. Molls, I say, begging. Raw meat? Jesus Christ, Jesus. Why didn't he take her to a fucking doctor? Why can't anyone step up and do something? I've never seen her this angry. She's crying. The tears sizzle on her cheeks. She paces, punching at the air. You know why? Because none of us can talk about anything. No one can be honest. Everyone's too fucking afraid. Elise, May says, what exactly did he say? It doesn't matter, Molly says, leaning down to pick up the bags. We're leaving. We can call 911 from the car. 911? I ask. Yeah. Have any better ideas? It's not a question. Come on, Mabes. I stand up, slip my arm under hers, and lift. She's not dead weight. She's helium. I'm not worried she'll fall if I let go. I'm worried she'll float away. Molly gets the door, propping it open for us with her foot. She's shaking her head at me, taking erratic breaths, muttering. Seeing her this upset is devastation I was not prepared for. I'm sorry, I whisper in May's ear. We were doing our best, she says. We are doing our best. The hotel is different now, hollow. It spits our sounds back at us, every footstep, every sigh. What do we do about Julie? We just leave her here? I ask May. She doesn't respond. May? I don't know, Lise. We turn the corner to the lobby. There's no one there. Everyone's gone. There's something unsettling about seeing a room like this empty. There's too much space for it not to be occupied. Light reflects between the mirrors on the walls. I can see dust particles swimming, delicate cobwebs in the corners. Molly lets the bags go. They smack against the ground like fallen bodies. Hello? Molly says, leaning over the reception desk. Hello? Is there a bag back there? I ask. Don't see one. Patsy should be back soon with my bag, I say. Here, you take May out to the car. I'll wait for Patsy. May clings to me. I love you. Love you too. Molly's taller than both of us. She hunches over to take May's weight. I notice she's looking beyond me, over my shoulder. Stop, she says. Don't. What? She brings a finger to her lips. Shh. Footsteps approaching. Is it Patsy? Molly's eyes widen. They get bigger and bigger. They're her whole face. May makes a sound like a siren. There's something terrible behind me. What is it? I ask. Molly sinks her nails into my wrist. She mouths, "Don't move." I catch a bad scent, rotten, acidic, sickening. Where are you going? A chill grabs me by the throat. It's Julie. Jules, I say, where are you going? We have to leave, I tell her. It's her. She's what's behind me. I don't look at her. I'm too afraid. Why? They're closing. See? There's no one around. We're the last ones here. She laughs. It's punctured by wheezing breaths. You okay, Jules? Elise, we need to leave, Molly says. We need to leave now. Go on, Molly. Go, Julie says. There's a strain in her voice, same as with an old heavy smoker's. It's difficult for her to talk and breathe at the same time. When she finishes speaking, she takes a desperate, rasping inhale. The exhale that follows is a dull scream. You too, May. You want to leave? Leave! Molly and May back up, back away from me. What is it? I ask them. You won't look at me, Lise? Jules asks. Don't, Molly says. Don't turn around. Come with us. Let's go. I don't know how far Julie is behind me, but I hear her take a step forward. There's the unmistakable sound of cracking bones. Jules, we need to get out of here. We have to leave. She laughs again. This time it's marked by sporadic gurgling. Like she's got too much saliva, or something stubborn is caught in her esophagus. I can't listen to that laugh anymore. I ask her, what is it? Don't you know? I'm not going anywhere. Molly and May are slowly stepping backward toward the front door. Elise, we're leaving. Come with us, Molly says. May, I say. She doesn't hear me. Her eyes are fixed on Julie. I should have said something. I should have asked, she says. She's talking to Julie. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry, maybe, Julie says. It's not a good look for you.
Elise, we're leaving, Molly says. Let's go.
Goodbye, Molly, Julie says.
Molly ignores her.
Elise, now.
It's fine,
Julie says. I didn't come back for them.
I came back for you.
Ah, Jules. I'm laughing now. Nervous, polite. Local news anchor laugh. You didn't have to do that.
I didn't have a choice, she says.
You wouldn't let me go.
I'm not sure what you're talking about, I say. A vicious cold sweeps over me. If she were close, I would feel the warmth of another human body, like when she used to sleep in my bed. I remember the extravagance of the extra heat. Come back to the hotel?
No, not to the hotel, she says. I'm not talking about the hotel. What's the matter with you?
With me?
You're smarter than this. You already know.
Julie, trust me, I'm lost.
You're choosing to be lost. It's frustrating me.
I'm sorry.
You don't know what I had to do to get here, what I have to do to stay here.
Stay where?
And to be treated like a freak by my best friends,
she says, anguished.
Enough! Molly's got the door open. Elise, come on!
Go, I tell her. Get May to a doctor. I'll meet you.
I'm not fucking around. Come with us.
Elise, May says. I wish she wouldn't say my name like that.
Let them go, Julie says.
We're right behind you, I say. Promise.
We?
Molly asks. I'm not leaving without Julie, I say. And when I hear it, I know it's true. Despite everything, I can't leave her. I just can't.
You won't leave without me?
Julie says.
You won't even look at me.
Moved by her pain, I turn around. She's much, much closer than I anticipated. Her skin isn't skin. It's a cratered, broken membrane stretched over her bones. It's got a weak sheen, the color of metal. Her lips have dried out, split, scabbed over. Her teeth, it seems she's got a fresh row of them, are yellow, too long, pointy. Red things dangle between them. The whites of her eyes are marbled, murky, her irises bleeding. The tip of her nose is gone. I can see the bone there. Her hair, the hair I once brushed, braided, straightened, is falling out in clumps. Her body is frail and thin, but her presence is domineering. She's taller, she's grown. As I take in the sight of her, the sudden ascent of terror overwhelms me, and I can't help but scream.
What?
She might be offended. She leans away from me.
It's not so bad.
Jules,
aren't you glad I'm here? Aren't you glad I'm not dead?
Of course.
Then why are you looking at me like that?
Julie?
Jules?
I need to repeat her name. I need to call her by it, confirm it out loud, because the thing in front of me bears little resemblance to my best friend.
You don't look well. I'm not well. Elise!
Molly keeps screaming.
Elise, now!
I turn to her.
I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving her like this.
Julie laughs.
Like what?
Jules.
Okay,
Molly says. She exchanges a look with May.
Okay, I can't make your decisions for you. I need to get May out of here.
Elise, come with us, May says, but she's already out the door. Molly to.
Don't, is the last thing I hear Molly say. The door closes.
It's quiet for a moment. Then Julie laughs.
Those two, she says, sighing. It's just us now. Just us.
Julie, can I help you? Can we go see a doctor?
I went to see doctors, all kinds of doctors. None of them could figure out what was wrong with me. They said I was fine.
Julie, I love you. Please, I don't think you're fine.
You think I don't know that?
I know. I'm aware. What happened?
You judge me.
I don't. I'm not. Tell me what happened. Behind her, I notice a trail of muddy footprints.
You don't care. None of you cares. You all look at me differently now. I can't take it.
She starts to cough, an intense, hacking cough that grinds on and on. She curls over, grasping at her side.
Jules?
She coughs up blood. She catches it in her palm. She sighs, wipes her hand against her thigh, smudging crimson across her loose jeans.
Julie, are you okay? You want to know what happened to me?
You said you didn't remember. She laughs.
I lied.
Are you going to tell me now? The truth?
You won't believe me.
I will, I promise.
Cross your heart?
I cross it.
Okay, I'll tell you. But let's go sit down somewhere. It's a long story. You want to go to the lounge?
I nod.
Come on,
she says, walking ahead of me. From behind, I can see the steep slope of her shoulders. She's hunching over. Her gait is off, like her legs hurt to walk on. She has to swing them to the sides to lift her feet. She sits on one of the big leather sofas. I sit near her, but not next to her. I hug a pillow just to have something between us.
Remember, she says, you promised.
I know, I say, picking at the pillow, avoiding eye contact. She coughs again, spits. Her breathing evens out. I've always been a curious person. I've finally come across a mystery I don't want solved, and here I am. What Julie remembers is this. He left wrappers in the sink again. There they were, floating in disgusting dishwater. The drain was blocked up by bits of beets and lettuce and walnuts from the salad she had made the night before. The beets gave the water a sinister red tint. Scene of the crime. How many times did she have to ask him? And why did she have to ask in the first place? Who puts wrappers in the sink? What grown man eats a candy bar and puts the wrapper in the sink? Why not throw it in the garbage? When it first happened, shortly after they moved in, she shrugged and threw the wrapper out herself. But then it happened again the next night, and the night after that. He had to have a candy bar after dinner. He'd been that way since he was a kid. His mother used to give him candy bars as a reward for good behavior. Julie realized she was basically married to Pavlov's dog. She was hyper aware of becoming a nag. Her mother was Queen Nag of Complain-a-Lot. That was probably why her dad left and why she never got a stepfather who stuck around. It was probably why her sister turned to pot, desperate to chill the fuck out while living under their mother's roof. And why the pot, in the end, wasn't enough. In a tragic twist of events, after getting kicked out of the house for the zillionth time, her sister pursued a different tyrant. She moved in with a powerful drug dealer. He had face tattoos and a scar across his neck. He beat her up on a regular basis. He might have actually been her pimp. Julie, on the other hand, refused to follow any type of predictable pattern that would land her in a therapist's office. The therapist crossing their legs and asking if she saw the parallel between X and her mother, Y and her father, Z and her childhood. She had eluded it this long. Her greatest test of all had been taking care of her mother before she died. The fussiest, most high-maintenance woman she'd ever known, sick and helpless and dying. Julie stayed patient through it all. She got her mother whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted it. Julie never snapped. She never asked the selfish questions like, "How come when I was six you told me I was fat?" Or, "What did you love about my father?" She had proved to herself that she had transcended her circumstances. She didn't have any intention of being broken by a stupid Snickers wrapper. But it wasn't just a Snickers wrapper. There were Milky Way and 100 grand and Reese's peanut butter cups. Every night, something different. She thought about asking to change their original arrangement, which was that she would cook and do dishes and do the laundry, and he would clean the rest of the house, bathrooms included, and do all the outside stuff, mow the lawn, garden. He was a contractor, a landscaper. He had the skills. It seemed like a fair deal. After taking care of her mother, she was grateful not to have to clean any bathrooms. She was happy with the deal at first, but as she stood over the sink each night, with him drinking a beer in another room, listening to records or watching TV, or tinkering with something in the house, her suspicion grew that she'd actually gotten the shit end of the stick. The bottle caps, too, from the beers. They would appear randomly around the house, at the foot of the stairs, on the bookshelf, on the vanity in the downstairs bathroom. Was it so hard to put a bottle cap in the recycling bin? After weeks of holding her tongue on principle, she gave in.
"How come you throw your wrappers in the sink instead of in the garbage?"
"Don't know," was his answer.
"Can you put them in the garbage instead?"
"Yeah, okay." But he didn't. Next night, same thing. That was when she began to ask herself questions. Why did the wrappers bother her so much? And the bottle caps? And how come he was always going on about missing socks in the laundry, like she'd lost them on purpose? What about all this got her so angry? Not annoyed, but angry. Scream into a pillow, angry. Pull out her hair, angry. Why was she putting up with this domestic shit? It was never what she wanted. She wanted to be famous. She wanted to be successful. Live in LA or New York, not small town Maine. Not own a bed and breakfast. Not be married to a hardcore Patriots fan who drank Sam Adams and didn't own dress shoes. What had happened? She was happy in the day-to-day, got swept up in it or the idea of it. It was picturesque. Their house was beautiful. The kind of house other people walked by and wished they'd lived in. It was peaceful where they were. And you got a view of the ocean from some of the rooms on the third floor. The beach was good for sitting on and reading. Not so much for swimming, but she didn't like swimming in the ocean anyway. Too many variables. Everyone in town was friendly. She knew them by name, and they knew her. She got the sense that all of the men were in love with her, and all the women were jealous. It could have been a lie she told herself to feel good. But most of the people had lived there their whole lives, and she was an outsider. There was an allure to that. She loved Tristan. He was gorgeous and made her laugh and was good to her. Checked all the boxes. He was the polar opposite of her in so many ways. It was fascinating. Initially. She couldn't tell if she loved him but wasn't in love with him, or was in love with him but didn't love him. She knew something was missing. Something had gone wrong. And her getting so worked up about the wrappers was just a symptom of a deeper problem. The beet water left her hands pinkish. She washed them and washed them until her knuckles were raw.
She went into the living room, where Tristan was drinking a beer and watching the news, and she said, "I'm going hiking tomorrow." He looked back at her, his eyebrows raised in surprise.
"Okay."
"By myself."
"All right. Where are you going?"
"Acadia." They had planned to go there together someday. That was why she picked it. She thought if she told him she was going alone to a place they were supposed to go to together, he'd get the hint that something was off. But he didn't.
"You need gear?"
he asked. That was when she realized what she really wanted was for him to stop her from going, to say, "No, stay, hang out with me, be with me." She was lonely. Her mother was dead, her sister was a crackpot. Her three best friends were scattered across the country. None of them was married. None of them would understand. Molly judged her for getting married in the first place. Didn't approve. May was too nice, too afraid to step on anyone's toes. It was impossible to get a genuine response from her. The one person who could give her honest advice was embroiled in an epically stupid affair. She had no advice to give. She was in the position only to receive.
"Yeah, I need gear," she said.
As she followed him down to the basement, she thought maybe it was good to put some space between them, give him a chance to miss her. She didn't sleep much that night. She got up before the sun, had some coffee, headed out. She listened to sugary pop music on the drive and sang along loudly, shamelessly botching the lyrics. She was excited to clear her mind for some alone time. For an adventure. It was the right call. She was feeling good. She was feeling free.
"Free," she says, "is my favorite feeling."
It was a perfect day. The sky was a pure, vivid blue. The air was fresh and delicious. She locked her car, double-checked her pack, threw it over her shoulders, and took off running. She ran. She couldn't walk. She couldn't wait another second to leave the rest of the world behind. From there, her memories get foggy. They cut in and out. She knows she set off on a particular trail, but she can't remember which one. She can't remember when her excitement faded, when the initial wonder of nature gave way to boredom and unease. Moss. She remembers moss. Moss-covered rocks along the trail. She remembers thinking of moss as forest mold and being angry at herself for having thoughts like that, ruining the experience. Being in the woods, she realized she had let her husband brainwash her into thinking she was outdoorsy. He was the one who liked to hike and camp, to rub sticks together and eat freeze-dried food. He was the one who could identify poison ivy and true north. Not her. She liked air conditioning and lattes and clean bathrooms. Being outside made her itchy. She hated being itchy. She hated bugs, and outside is where all the bugs live. The woods gave her bad vibes. The trees stood around like sullen overlords, dense and dark and ancient. The other plants, fern-looking things, she didn't find particularly impressive. She distrusted them. She suspected they were harboring bugs. After walking for a while, she decided she deserved a rest. She came across a fallen tree overlooking a shallow stream. She sat on the tree and bit into one of the protein bars her husband had packed for her. It tasted like rubber. She took out her phone, pulled up maps. It was around this time she became aware that someone was watching her. She got a sensation like pins and needles from her shoulder up the side of her neck. She didn't want to give any indication, acknowledge its presence with the eruption of sudden movement. She slowly turned to face the trees behind her. There was a rustling of branches, but no person, no animal, no eyes emerging from the shade. A squirrel. That was the narrative she decided on. It was a squirrel. She returned to her phone. Something wasn't right. According to maps,
She was a blue dot in a sea of white nothing. She hadn't brought a paper map, hadn't thought she would need one. She put her phone down, took another bite of her protein bar. The brief lapse of mental stimulation made her vulnerable. It allowed doubt to creep in. There was no way that was a squirrel. She saw the branches move. She heard them murmur. There was too much movement, too much noise to come from a squirrel. Pewter rats, as she called them. It could have been a fellow hiker, which should have brought her comfort, because she realized she hadn't seen any other hikers in a long time. An hour, at least. It was a weekday, so maybe the park wasn't crowded. She tried not to overthink the situation. She tried to ignore the image she had in her head of some man leering at her from behind a tree. She could go home. She could walk back the way she had come, get in her car, drive, stop at some random diner, drink buckets of coffee, and get the solo time she'd been craving. Or go straight home, rest safe in her husband's arms. Maybe this was the answer she was after. She missed the sense of security she felt when she was with him, the feeling of home. She missed being in their beautiful dream house, being able to crack the windows and hear nature, but not have to be in it, slapping off mosquitoes and managing squirrel paranoia. Maybe she needed to try harder to make her life work. She tucked her protein bar wrapper in her back pocket, drank a few swigs of water, took a moment to appreciate the shimmer of sunlight on the stream. She was ready to turn around, head back, but she found something about the path that unspooled behind her less appealing than the way ahead. The leaves weren't as green. She reconsidered leaving. She had come for a reason. She didn't want to bail. That was her habit, wasn't it? When things got hard, she left. When they weren't hard, she got bored, and she left. She didn't want to be that way, always leaving. She chose to forget about whatever was watching her from the woods. It wasn't watching her then. At least, she didn't feel like it was. She didn't know it was. She followed the stream, carefully selecting which stone to step on next, like an elaborate game of hopscotch. She avoided checking the time, knowing if it was earlier than she expected, she would get impatient, and if it was later, she would feel rushed. Only she realized she'd wandered off the path, and she wasn't sure how far she had gone or how long she had been on this detour. She didn't want to give in to negativity, but the truth was, she was fighting a losing battle against escalating dread. She reasoned with herself. She'd been in worse binds than this. She'd been stuck in Amsterdam with no money, her passport lost, her phone smashed, and still she had made it home. She'd figure it out, find her way back. She always did. She ignored her distress. She set her pack down, hydrated, hid behind a tree, got herself together. She went along, concentrating on the satisfying crunch of ground beneath her feet. Then, she heard the first twig snap. She spun around before her fear could stop her. In the woods behind her, obscured partly by the slope of the land, was a person. Not really a person, a figure. What scared her most wasn't that it was there, that she shared the woods with someone or something else. It was that whatever it was dressed in head-to-toe black. It cocked its head to one side, looking at her with curiosity, but it didn't have eyes, none that she could see. Her body reacted strangely, adrenaline pushing her forward instead of pulling her back. When she took a step toward the figure, it dropped on all fours and scuttled into the brush. She stood there for a minute. The way it had moved, there was no way it was human. But she'd never seen any animal stand upright on its hind legs like that, even bears hunch. And its arms, it had long, skinny arms. She couldn't quantify its size because of the distance. It could have been under 3 feet tall. It could have been over 7. There was no question of going back now. To go back would be to walk toward it. Her only option was to hurry forward and hope it didn't catch up, or to find other hikers and make fast friends. It'd become too difficult to run in her bulky hiking boots, strapped into a heavy backpack. She power walked, took long strides, tested her legs. Her shins ached, her quads, her shoulders. Her feet were blistered. She looked straight ahead. She didn't let her eyes stray. She didn't want to see, didn't want to know. She thought about calling a park ranger, but she had zero reception. They say to bring a walkie-talkie or some shit, but she hadn't. She tried maps again. Nothing. Not even a blue dot. The hike became more challenging, the sun less generous, the trees taller. The wind picked up. That was her first clue about the turn in the weather. The forecast was all cute yellow sun, but the smell in the air was unmistakable. It was the smell of the earth ripening for a storm. The reality sank in. People disappear. It happens all the time. They leave to pick up bread or soap or cigarettes or AA batteries, and they never come back. Their families are left to wonder. They can't eat toast or wash their hands or smoke or use the remote control without it coming back to haunt them. Kids wander off at the playground or in grocery store parking lots or waiting for the bus, and they're never seen again. Their parents plead on the news, put up posters. They're dead, she used to think. Do they know, or are they delusional with hope? When she was a kid, she pictured her own face on one of those posters. It didn't scare her. She always coveted attention. She imagined her classmates crying, hugging one another, people searching with German shepherds and flashlights, calling out her name over and over again. Now the idea made her woozy, because the figure was behind her again. Not exactly behind her. It walked beside her, but in the woods, concealing itself. It was so dark, so tall, and gangling. It was like a walking shadow. She was able to pacify herself a few times by telling herself it was a shadow. But then she'd see the trees move, hear its footsteps. Her phone wasn't working, but she pretended. Hey, yeah, I'll be there soon. You there? Yeah, I'm like right by you. I'll be there soon. Are Chris and John with you? Cool. Cool. Yeah, see you soon. You too. Bye. When she fake hung up, she thought she heard laughing. A low, evil laugh, unlike anything she'd ever heard before. She tried to move faster, but her legs refused. Her adrenaline wasn't working the same. It wasn't sustaining her. Her realization was punctuated by the first flash of lightning, followed by a booming clap of thunder. She couldn't stop to take out her poncho. She didn't have time. She was being hunted. She knew, by the severity of her panic, by the tenseness of her body, that she was prey. By the time the rain came, she was running. She wasn't fast enough. It clipped her ankle and dragged her down. She fell face first into the mud and hit her head on a rock. The impact knocked out her vision. She clawed around in the dark. She couldn't scream because of all the mud she'd swallowed. She couldn't say anything. In the darkness, she tried to calm herself down, to sense whether she was in any pain. Her ankle burned, but the pain wasn't terrible. She tried to rotate her foot and realized whatever had caught her was still holding on. Its hand was wrapped around her ankle. Its hand, or a rope, or its mouth, she couldn't tell. She kicked. The laughing came again. It was a sound she says she can't describe, but even if she could, she wouldn't want to. She says she prayed. She prayed to a God she didn't believe in until that moment. She thought about her husband at home and the candy wrappers in the sink she no longer gave a flying fuck about. She kicked with her free leg. Her foot connected with something. Her vision came back, blurry, her eyelashes encased in mud. She saw that she was free and that whatever was attacking her was far enough away that if she ran hard and fast and for her life, she could get away. So that is what she did. She couldn't breathe. Her chest was on the verge of exploding. Her legs were on fire, but she was creating distance. She was escaping. She didn't know then. There was no escape. She didn't understand until it caught her the fourth time. Both her ankles were shredded to the point that she could see the skin hanging off like party streamers. She didn't know until she felt the size of the gash on her neck, until she pulled her hand away and saw how red it was. It had let her go. When it wanted, it let her go. It was a game. It was sport. She hid anyway, knowing it would find her again, knowing there was nothing she could do but buy herself more time. She hid in the hollowed trunk of a dead tree, marveling at the magnitude of her fear. And when it took her for the last time, she was able to see what it really looked like. She said, "Please." She thought she was asking for mercy. Maybe that was what she got. It pinned her to the ground, each of its long, spindly branches, not limbs. That was not what they were, not exactly, digging into her, cutting off her circulation. Its head hovered over her head, its mouth, not a human mouth or an animal mouth, but a fissure, a nest, a leak, a void, clamped down. She didn't want to be afraid anymore. She was about to die, and she resigned herself to it. In her final moments, she decided she wanted to think of her happiest memory. She found it easy. "The last thing I saw," she says, smiling, "was your face." Next thing she knew, she was buried in the dirt. Not deep. Through it, she could see sunlight. She could breathe. Instinct would have her break out, but something stronger stopped her. She stayed. Not because of it. She knew the creature that put her there wasn't a threat to her anymore. Her thoughts were familiar. They were her thoughts, Julie's thoughts. Only it was like she was reading them off a cue card, or they were being fed to her through an earpiece. There was a disconnect in how she thought, what she thought and what she felt, a detachment. The truth was, she didn't feel much of anything. She'd always been someone with strong emotions, sensitive. She walked around feeling like a raw nerve. She couldn't watch the news because it would make her hysterical, send her into an existential crisis. She couldn't have a weird dream without it ruling her day. A rude barista at Starbucks could keep her up at night. All of that was muffled now. Some monster had stalked her in the woods, attacked her, buried her, and she was feeling fine. Not great. Not bad. Fine. She doesn't know how long she stayed buried there. Eventually, she got hungry. Getting out required more digging than she expected. That didn't matter. Her nails were long now, sharp. She thought about how human nails keep growing after death. That was a thing, wasn't it? When she saw it again, however long later, she felt an immediate kinship. It watched her emerge from the dirt. It wasn't so ugly to her now. It turned away from her, revealing its exposed spine, its bones. Its skin, maybe bark, was tight and stretched thin. It looked like ash, like it was something else once, burned beyond recognition. She was following it now. But that was what it wanted. That was what they did. they followed. They lived together, in shadow, they and the others. They traveled together from place to place. They preferred the woods, the camouflage of the trees, but it didn't really matter. What mattered was that wherever they were, they could feed. She didn't know what they were, not exactly, but she knew she was one of them. She knew she had been chosen, but she didn't know why.
"Really, I think I chose for myself," she says. "My whole life, I wanted to be something else, wanted something more, to escape my body, my life as it was. It could sense that in me, my hunger, my longing, my fight, my strength." She seems confident in this. I'm sure it's easier for her to accept if she tells herself it was her choice, that it wasn't decided for her, that it wasn't something that happened to her. I can't blame her for this. I won't take it from her, even though I don't believe it. I believe she was taken because she was there, a pretty blonde, alone in the woods, lost. There are many reasons why bad things happen to young women, and at the same time, no reason at all. Julie knew that she died and wasn't dead. She knew she was hungry, so she ate. There was a faint voice that sang in her ears sometimes as she fell asleep. Her memories of her husband, of her house, of what it was like to drive a car, of how good it felt to have a stiff drink on a Friday night, of her friends. Of everything and everyone she had left behind, I was what she remembered the most. She worried the most about me. The worry distracted her. The distraction made her weak. The others took notice. When she asked if she could go, they nodded. The nod was consent. They couldn't speak. Or they could, but she didn't yet understand the language. When she left for her former home, they didn't watch. They didn't follow. Her memories came back in droves. The closer she got, the more she felt like herself again. She even looked like her old self. She was really, truly coming back to life. By the time she arrived on her front porch, she was 100% certain.